Our first speaker today is Dr. Peter Dennis. Peter taught philosophy at the London School of Economics before training to become a secondary school teacher. He's currently head of religion and philosophy at Brighton College. And Peter's talk today is entitled Teaching Epistemic Virtues. Without further ado, I will leave you in Peter's capable hands. I'm going to spotlight his video and he's going to share a PowerPoint with you. Peter, take it away.
Thank you, John. Let me just bring up my PowerPoint. Well, thanks, John, for that introduction. As John said, I was in academic philosophy before training as a secondary school teacher, and I was working on epistemology, theory of knowledge, and in particular, I was looking at social epistemology. So this talk brings together those two interests. I'll be speaking about teaching epistemic virtues, and I'll start off with a quick definition and give some examples of epistemic virtues. And I'll say something about why they matter. And then we'll get to this question of how they can be taught. And I'll be answering that question with reference to a practical teaching method called philosothon, which can be used in the classroom, or it can be used as a big inter-school competition, a little bit along the lines of school debating or model UN, a discussion format, somewhat in that category. So that will be the practical bit of the talk. So let's start with the theoretical bit. What are epistemic virtues? Well, these are character traits that equip a person to achieve the goals of inquiry. So the goals of inquiry being truth, understanding, and knowledge. And somebody that's well disposed to acquire those things is likely someone who's going to be attentive, open-minded, curious about the world, maybe creative, discerning, is going to have good judgment. These epistemic virtues are any kind of character trait that make it more likely that we're going to achieve the goals of inquiry, truth, and knowledge. So here's a kind of stock list here up on the slide. Why do they matter? Well, by definition, the epistemic virtues are character traits that help you achieve truth and knowledge. So clearly they matter epistemically. And if we think about why it's important to teach them in the classroom, well, assuming that schools don't just set out to teach all of the knowledge and understanding that a person will require throughout their lives, we also need to make people likely to acquire truth and knowledge and understanding later on in life. And that means equipping them with these epistemic virtues, these character traits that make achieving those things more likely. So they're essential for lifelong learning. Secondly, they're socially useful. Clearly, societies where individuals possess these traits, or curious societies, open-minded societies, clearly they're going to do better epistemically. In other words, they're going to acquire more knowledge. Science is going to do better in those societies. But they're not just better epistemically. Kasim Kassam has written recently about extremism as a certain mindset of closed-mindedness, unwillingness to compromise, a desire for purity. So if you think about those characteristics, they're somewhat the opposite of our epistemic virtues of being open-minded, curious about other people, willing to change one's views. So by making people more epistemically virtuous, they're less likely to fall victim to extremism and that's that sort of thing. So societies do better when we're epistemically virtuous. And I think, just finally, these are things that are just good things to be, okay? So it's if you're open-minded and creative, even if that doesn't lead to any further benefits, epistemic or otherwise, these are just good things to be. So maybe even they're morally good. Now, a key claim that I'd like to persuade you of during this talk is that these epistemic virtues are social. And what I mean by that is that epistemic virtues are either completely social or they're partially social. And when I say that an epistemic virtue is completely social, what I mean is that it characterizes us purely in terms of our social relations with others. So take a virtue like charity, which we said was one of these initial epistemic virtues on our first list. A charitable person is somebody that when they're faced with interpreting a view they might disagree with, when they've got two potential interpretations of that view, a more plausible one and a less plausible one, they're automatically going to pick the plausible one as the correct interpretation of their opponent's view. And they're going to focus on maybe attacking that more plausible version or engaging with that more plausible version of the view rather than attacking a straw man. Well, if charity is an epistemic virtue, then clearly this is a wholly social one. You can't be charitable on your own. You're only charitable if you're interpreting other people's views in a charitable way. Not all epistemic virtues are like that. Some are just partially social. So take, for example, the virtue of attentiveness. Imagine a scientist in a laboratory peering down the lens of a microscope. We would want that person to be attentive to the content of that microscope slide when they're making their observations. But I think we wouldn't say that the scientist was fully attentive unless they were also attentive to the opinions of their colleagues in that laboratory, attentive to the literature, attentive to the views of their epistemic peers elsewhere in the scientific community who are also working on that topic. So the attentive person is attentive when they're making observations of the world, but they're also attentive to other people. And I'd want to argue that you can't be fully attentive if you're just interested in to use our example of what's on the microscope slide, unless you're attentive to other people. So let's just see some more examples, or we'll see some more examples in a minute. Just first off, I wanted to make a little philosophical reference. Anybody brought up in the tradition of traditional epistemology, modern epistemology, going back to Descartes, might notice this as a slightly counter-traditional view. Arguably, Descartes' view was that to find certain knowledge, we had to retreat into the individual self, and almost the ideal epistemic subject, the ideally virtuous inquirer, was somebody who essentially retreated on into their own company and investigated by themselves. So here's Descartes in a famous passage right at the beginning of his Meditations on First Philosophy. He says, "I realized that if I wanted to establish anything in the sciences that was stable and likely to last, I needed, just once in my life, to demolish everything completely and start again from the foundations. So today, I have set all my worries aside and arranged for myself a clear stretch of free time. And this is the crucial bit. I'm here quite alone, and at last, I will devote myself sincerely and without holding back to demolishing my opinions." In other words, if we want to get certain knowledge, we'd better step back from the world, step back from other people, and investigate this in an individualistic way. And perhaps this is present in a certain kind of mythology about mad scientists, the trope of the mad scientist that's there in the laboratory discovering things for him or herself, true to their principles, pursuing their scientific investigations. But if epistemic virtues are social, then this is just the wrong perception of the epistemically virtuous subject or the ideal subject of inquiry. So here are some more examples of how epistemic virtues are either wholly social, as in the case of charity, or partially social, as in the case of attentiveness. Take honesty. I think this is another one that belongs on the left-hand side of wholly social virtues. You can't be honest without relating to other people. Of course, you could say, well, there's such a thing as being honest with yourself. But even being honest with yourself presupposes a formal interlocutor. And often, in order to be honest with ourselves, the best way of doing that is to go and find a real interlocutor, someone else that you can talk to, for example, a therapist. And that's often a really good way of being honest with yourself, to speak to somebody else and see if you're really free from self-deception. Again, open-mindedness, I'd want to put this in this category as well, though maybe this is the most controversial one. certainly if we define open-mindedness as being willing to consider viewpoints other than one's own, that looks like a social virtue to me. You can't be open-minded on your own on a desert island. You're going to need to be surrounded by other people who might think differently from you in order to even operate and display this virtue at all. Maybe this one will come up in the Q&A. I think there are a number of things that you could say to argue this one should be on the right-hand side, but at least we've got two on as these holy social epistemic virtues. And all of the others that we mentioned, they've got social dimensions. So it's hard to say how someone could be fully creative unless they were also creative in building agreement with other people, finding out where disagreement lies, and perhaps identifying some common assumptions and then going away and testing those assumptions. Curious, again, a curious person is going to be curious about other people and other people's points of view, not just about the world. Discernment, this one's got a long tradition in the theological tradition, discerning a prophet who's really kind of speaking, who's speaking for God. That's got a long tradition in theology, and that there, that's a kind of social value. So we might think about good judgment being making good judgments about the world, but it's also in evaluating other people's expertise, deciding who is an epistemic peer, to update the theological idea a little bit. Equally, objectivity, similar to honesty, often the best way of being objective is being willing to confront and learn from the views of others, confronting your own biases. And again, integrity. I think this is one that arguably doesn't belong on the list at all. You could say that the person with integrity, think about a scientist, is the scientist that pursues their principles relentlessly, driving towards their own conclusions and refusing to be swayed by other people until they've found out the truth. But I think that's a misguided conception of what integrity is, particularly in science. Imagine a scientist that's rightly convinced of the truth of their conclusion. They believe their conclusion, and that belief counts as knowledge. And in order to get some new funding or to make their conclusion kind of more attractive, they fudge the results a little bit. That's somebody that's relentlessly pursuing their conclusion, but I don't think we'd say it's the person that's acting with integrity, because part of integrity also is respecting the rules of an epistemic community, rules about keeping a lab book correctly, rules about peer review and fabricating results. And the person with integrity is the person that obeys those rules, those social rules, even when no one's watching. So that's a big part of this claim that I want to make, that epistemic virtues are sociable. And what that means is, based on the table that we've just seen, is that with certain of these epistemic virtues, like charity, honesty, open-mindedness, you can't possess those virtues at all unless you skillfully relate to others. That's part of what it is to be charitable, honest, and open-minded. Indeed, I've argued that it's the whole of what it is to be those things. Others, we make a slightly weaker claim that you can't be fully creative, fully attentive, curious, discerning, objective, or possess integrity without skillfully relating to others. And from this, I'd just like to extract a few corollaries that help us with what we're going to talk about next, which is about how to teach these epistemic virtues. Well, it follows that the epistemically virtuous person is a socially skilled agent. Okay, so we've hopefully debunked that idea of the mad scientist working in the lab on their own, and that's the ideal epistemic subject. Instead, it's the person that talks to their colleagues, engages with the epistemic community, and is reflective and sensitive to other people's points of view. But it's not just somebody that's socially skilled, as in sort of the gregarious person, the person that's fun to talk to at a party, the friendly person. It's somebody that possesses social skills in the epistemic domain. So the epistemically virtuous person isn't necessarily fun at a party. They're not necessarily the friendly person. But in the epistemic domain, when they're dealing with their colleagues, and this could be, for example, at an academic conference like this one, or even when they're writing in that academic journal, they're somebody that's relating skillfully to others in their epistemic activity. So when they're making those observations in the laboratory, they've got in the back of their mind other people's views, other people's theories that might interpret those observations differently. And whether they're in company or not, they're automatically responding to other people. Okay, so it won't be enough to teach epistemic virtues just by teaching social skills. These are, if you like, social epistemic skills. Okay, so teaching epistemic virtue is likely to involve the teaching of what I'm calling social epistemic skills, skills that are at once social and epistemic. So let's move on to the third question then. We've spoken about what these epistemic virtues are. We've said something about why they matter. But how can we teach these epistemic virtues? And a good deal of what I'm going to say about how to teach epistemic virtues would apply just the same to what I would say about how to teach any virtue at all. And a lot of work has been done by this, particularly by James Arthur, who leads the Centre for Character and Virtue at the University of Birmingham. Here's a familiar idea from James Arthur. He says, a person cannot acquire the virtues, and he's talking about moral virtues principally here, but I think we can generalise to virtues generally, merely by listening to lectures. Character, instead, can be taught, sought, and caught. And it is the interaction between all three that determines the effectiveness of any character-forming activities. Okay, so there's a lot in that quote, but I think we can pull out four things from there within sort of to spell out what is broadly an Aristotelian model of how the virtues are taught. So first on our list, we've got explicit instruction. Arthur's conscious to point out that explicit instruction alone isn't going to cut it, but I think there's still a place for explicit instruction. Telling school pupils, for example, what the epistemic virtues are and how to embody them. Secondly, through modelling those virtuous behaviours, either as a teacher or allowing pupils to see those virtuous behaviours modelled in their peers. And thirdly, I would add perhaps to Arthur's, the ideas that are expressed in Arthur's quote, providing the right incentives. So Aristotle says, we ought to have been brought up so as both to delight in and to be pained by the things that we ought. And he defines that as the right education. Okay, so if we want to encourage children to be epistemically virtuous, we'd better make sure in our incentive structure that we're providing the right incentives. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this when I come to talk about philosophon. But just to kind of maybe contrast that with another format, say school debating, which is quite often practiced in schools. Are we rewarding people for being curious, open-minded, willing to change their view? Or are we perhaps rewarding people for being closed-minded, sticking to a particular opinion and arguing it and wanting to be right at all costs? So I definitely think there's a place for things like school debating. But when we're thinking about these activities, we might just consider whether we're providing the right incentives if what we aim to do is to promote epistemic virtue. Of course, that's not the only thing we might intend to do in the classroom. There might also be a case for training pupils to defend an idea, come what may. And then just lastly, providing the opportunity to practice is clearly going to be key if we want pupils to develop epistemic virtues. Aristotle famously said that states of character arise out of like activities. So we've got to give pupils plenty of time to practice being curious, being creative, being open-minded, being discerning. But if I'm right that these are social ideas, we've got to give them time to practice this skill in social settings. Okay, so this is one argument that you might make for the importance of group work in science lessons, in the humanities, in any area of inquiry. It's not just about learning the best of what's been discovered, but also if we want to train people to cultivate these epistemic virtues, we've got to give them plenty of opportunity to practice. And that might sometimes come at the cost of using lesson time to teach them facts and knowledge. Okay, so I'm going to talk now about the practical example of philosothon and how this might be used to teach the epistemic virtues. Philosothon, if you haven't heard of it, is a discussion format that's become very popular in Australasia. It originated in Australasia, and it's become more and more popular in the UK over the last few years. So this poster is taken from a competition that I organised at Stowe last year. And you can see from the slogan on the poster how directly it's sort of linked with these epistemic virtues. So first of all, it's a competition. There are going to be incentives. And there are going to be incentives for people who display these epistemic virtues, intellectually curious people, for example. People who are interested in discovering the truth, for example, they're going to be rewarded in this competition. And those that have just come along to win the argument and best their opponents, we get the impression already that they're not going to do very well. And that's absolutely the case. So in terms of how it works, this was set up as a big inter-school competition. We had about 13 schools, independent schools, state schools, grammar schools involved from various places in the UK. And each school entered a team of 10 pupils in year groups from year 9 up to year 13. So two in each year group. And then the pupils are randomized into what we're calling communities of inquiry. And those communities of inquiry have got to work together to reach some conclusions based on rational deliberation. Okay, so here we can see one of the discussion rounds. And they're given some written discussion prompts, and they're told you've got 5 minutes to read this discussion prompt. You haven't seen it before. And you've got 15 minutes to deliberate and talk about it and reach some conclusions that you can all agree on. So there is a certain emphasis on agreement, but I should point out that the aim isn't that they all kind of homogenize and just agree on the same thing for the sake of it. The agreement could be something like, well, we actually disagree about this problem, but this is the root of our disagreement. We disagree because we're conflicted about this particular assumption. And that would be a way of summarizing, in a way, the discussion. So it's mutual acceptance in a pretty broad sense. Here's an example of one of the discussion prompts. So the text on the left, it might be a little bit small to read. It's a excerpt from Jack and the Beanstalk. And the questions on the right, which hopefully you can see, take the pupils through in a kind of gradated way with a bit of a difficulty curve. Some questions in traditional epistemology and then later in contemporary social epistemology. So the first couple of questions just sort of check and canvas their intuitions. Should Jack have trusted the little old man who promises to give him the magic beans that are going to grow into a giant beanstalk? Is it wise to trust a stranger in the marketplace? And the second question is asking whether that belief of Jack's counted as knowledge or was it just a lucky guess? So what we found is by using a stimulus like this one, the first couple of questions instantly generate a fair bit of disagreement. We found that this tends to split the group quite nicely. And then it's up to them to explore those different points of view and to collaborate to solve the quite difficult philosophical questions that then come later. So, for example, question 3, That's the $64,000 question in epistemology. What counts as knowledge? What does it mean to say somebody knows something? And then we've got some more recent questions that epistemologists have asked, such as, is testimony reliable evidence? And what do we need? What needs to be the case in order for us to trust directions from a complete stranger, for example? Okay, so that's one of the examples of the discussion prompts. It's up to the pupils to manage their own discussion. And this is key, and I think very much helps them practice these epistemic virtues. Because it's up to them to lead their own discussion, they've got to practice and take responsibility for listening to each other and making sure that everybody is included. So there's not a teacher there who's calling on pupils by name and making sure everybody is listened to. That's precisely what we want the students to do. But there is a facilitator, but their job is just really to keep time. So in an ideal setting, the facilitator is just like a pilot flying a plane on autopilot. They're just there to monitor, making sure nothing is going wrong. But really, the discussion should look after itself and come to a three-point landing. Sometimes we ask the facilitators when there's a minute to go just to say, right, can you maybe come to some conclusions and what have you agreed upon? But largely, it's up to the pupils to choose how much time to spend on each question, and they're responsible for moderating the discussion. There's also a judge in each group. So this harks back to Aristotle's point about incentives. It is a competition, but the pupils aren't rewarded based on how clever they can be, how much they know about philosophy. In fact, they don't need any prior background in philosophy. In fact, it's best if they don't have any prior background. That really helps when you're leading through the questions from the beginning, to see them think about those questions for the first time. And because they're difficult, they need to collaborate with the others and consider different points of view. There's a judge who says nothing. Their job is just to listen into the conversation, and they score each pupil individually based on how well they contribute to the goals of collective inquiry. And by definition, somebody that makes a good contribution to the goals of collective inquiry is going to be the epistemically virtuous person, because that's just how we defined epistemic virtues in the beginning. These were character traits that a person with those, if they've got those character traits, will achieve the goals of inquiry, so truth, understanding, and knowledge. Here are the criteria for judges, which I think maybe is the most important thing to focus on. A student that dominates the discussion or doesn't contribute or just wants to win, so they ask rhetorical questions, they're just grandstanding or showing off, or they just want to be right, so they're willing to defend a position even if they don't have much evidence for it. That's clearly not the epistemically virtuous person, and they're not going to score well on philosophon. So again, maybe it's just worth having in the back of your mind debating and seeing the different incentive structure that philosophon has compared with debating. If you're doing a little bit better, you're moving a bit towards epistemic virtue, you're building on the ideas of others, you're listening, you're demonstrating those virtues of attentiveness. Moving up the range, if you're sharing observations and ideas, if you respond respectfully to other people, and then if you're able to adjust your own views and your own responses in the light of what others have said, well, that's very much the attentive, open-minded, social, epistemic, virtuous person that we want to incentivize and reward. Are you questioning your peers? Are you curious about what they think and why they disagree with you before you automatically launch into a rebuttal? And then right at the top there, do you actually show intellectual leadership? And I think I would almost want to add intellectual leadership to that original list of epistemic virtues. And that would belong on the left-hand side of our table when we split epistemic virtues into ones that are wholly social and ones that are partially social. Definitely belongs with the ones that are wholly social. Clearly, you can't show intellectual leadership on your own. If you're assisting in facilitation, bringing other people in, or if you're pointing out two people who have disagreed with each other, but maybe they've disagreed because they've taken for granted a common assumption that needs to be tested, you're assisting in facilitation and you're showing that intellectual leadership. So these judging criteria are courtesy of Mark Smith, who heads up an organisation called Philosothon UK. And I'll put details for that organisation in my final slide. Prizes, again, harking back to the idea of incentivising, prizes are rewarded for the winning school and for the winning pupil in each year group. And that really helps create a buzz about this competition. I should say, although this was a big inter-school competition that we organised, and that's really Philosothon in its natural habitat, I've also used this successfully with classes when I've been teaching philosophy to give them a stimulus around the topic that I'm teaching. Works really well as a starter activity or to get pupils interested in the topic. And indeed, just in a classroom setting, if your goal was simply to teach those epistemic virtues, whether or not you're teaching philosophy, it works incredibly well. So what impact did it have on the pupils, and how do we know this works? Well, we handed out surveys at the end of the Philosothon, and out of about 130 pupils, we got 100 surveys back. It's good to see that most of them enjoyed it. Even better to see that they felt listened to, because that showed that there were virtues of attentiveness and open-mindedness and curiosity being enacted. But the bit of evidence that I think is most compelling for me is the number of people that changed their mind about the issues discussed. So to have 92% of people who actually came into the competition believing one thing, and then as a result of what they'd heard during the discussion, they actually changed their mind, really shows that they were indeed practicing and using those epistemic virtues. Here's some of the qualitative feedback that we received. And it's interesting to see how many of these reference the epistemic virtues, either directly or indirectly. So the beginning of the competition began with everybody in an auditorium where some of the goals of Philosothon were explained. So they did have a brief explanation of the epistemic virtues and what we were looking for in the competition. But even so, it's wonderful to see these things in the pupils' own words. So right in the center there, the virtue of open-mindedness is spoken about. Cooperation being a big one, curiosity, how to incorporate other people's views into your own question, you know, or into your own ideas. That seems really, really important. And it's an idea of displaying a social skill, but it's a social skill that's epistemic as well. So we're not just listening to others in the coffee break, we're listening to others within our own belief-forming process. Top left there, dominating an argument is far worse than listening to other people's ideas. Flexibility being mentioned as well, and a willingness to compromise. So harking back to Kasim Kassam's definition of extremism as a mindset of being unwilling to compromise. It really seems like something that is worthwhile to do in the context of the fight against extremism as well. Okay, I think I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to open it up to questions. But to find out more, there's the Philosothon UK website. That's the second bullet point down. There's the Stowe Philosothon that I organised, and the webpage is still up, so you can see examples of discussion prompts, and you're welcome to share those prompts and use them with your own pupils. There's the page on the Ian Ramsey Centre, which is one funding from the Templeton Foundation to promote Philosothon in the UK. And please get in touch with me if you'd like more information. You've got my email address, or I tweet at Dr. P. Dennis. Okay, so I'll hand over to John, who I think is going to chair the Q&A.
Great. Thank you so much, Peter. That was extremely interesting and extremely useful. And you can see from the chat and the many questions being asked, there's a lot of interest in this, particularly on resources for Philosothon. So I see you've shared some there, Peter, and Laura's also shared a link in the chat. If there are any other links people are aware of, please share them there. Peter's very kindly shared his email address there, and so you can get in touch with him for further resources. And I'm right in thinking, Peter, that you plan to run more of these in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to see what happens, obviously, with COVID this year, but fully intend to organise one at Brighton College either this year or next. So do get in touch with me if you're within striking distance of Brighton.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, so I'm going to go through some of these questions. Okay, so the first question from user Apicard asks, I have a question regarding the presumably wholly social nature of charity and open-mindedness. You said we need other people to display those virtues. Would you say this includes the written ideas of the people? I can be a charitable and open-minded reader, can't I, even if I'm on my own?
Yes, yeah, definitely. I would say it includes that. I did suspect that some of these would get picked up on in the Q&A. I think I'm most confident that charity is a fully social epistemic virtue. I'm reasonably confident that honesty is. Open-mindedness, I could imagine it being argued the other way. I've defined it as being open-minded to other people's views. Of course, you could say, well, there's another kind of open-mindedness that is, you're just open-minded about the conclusion, and you can identify within your own mind a range of views in logical space, and you're open-minded about which of those is true. I'd still want to argue that that falls short of genuine open-mindedness, because after all, suppose you've arranged a sort of 10 or 20 potential views in logical space. These are, after all, your own views that you're then going to kind of choose from. I think it's only genuine open-mindedness when you're really open-minded to somebody else's view and you're willing to consider that. So I'd want to fight for open-mindedness as belonging to that on that list as well. But absolutely, to answer the question, it includes in the written form as well. Absolutely. I think, you know, if you're an academic or a student, I mean, that's the social part of inquiry is that you're mainly not at an event like this one talking with your colleagues. You're precisely reading people's ideas in written form, but social nonetheless.
Great. Thank you very much, Peter. Next question is from Dominic Balg. He asks, while I agree that epistemic virtues are not simply social skills, I would like to know what the exact relation between epistemic virtues and social skills will plausibly look like against a social interpretation of epistemic virtues. For example, isn't it plausible to think that the degree to which a person is open-minded will crucially depend on her ability to understand other people's perspectives and thus on how empathetic she is?
Yeah, I think that's likely to be empirically true, that somebody who generally is emotionally intelligent, empathetic, and maybe is fun at a party is likely to possess those skills in the epistemic context as well. I suppose that's an empirical question, whether it's true or not. My sense is that a certain amount of emotional intelligence is going to be helpful for these epistemic skills. But I want to leave open the possibility that it's not always the case. I think we can all think of people who, in their epistemic life, are extremely responsive to the views of others, thoughtful, creative, open-minded along the social dimensions of those epistemic virtues, but maybe very socially anxious, socially awkward, not fun at a party, maybe not even very empathetic. You know, the idea of the intellectual recluse who kind of retreats into their library of books, sort of linking in with the first question, may not be the most emotionally intelligent or socially capable person. Nonetheless, within the authors that they're reading and their contemporaries whose work they're responding to in a sensitive, reflective, open-minded way, they may well develop those virtues. So I think I think as an empirical question, it's likely that going out for children, going out into the playground and being social with their friends, whether they're talking about epistemic questions or just talking about the weather, that's likely to be good in terms of their development, and it's going to be laying the foundation for those epistemic social skills. But I wouldn't want to say that necessarily the person that's got those epistemic social skills is always the person that's the most socially skilled.
Great. Thank you very much, Peter. Okay. The next question is from Christina Eaton. Christina, you've asked a couple of questions and you've said that you're happy to ask yours. So how about I unmute you? Can you decide which of yours you'd like to ask? Okay, so you can unmute yourself if you like now, Christina, and ask Peter your question.
Hi, Christina.
Hello. Yeah, I really loved the philosophon idea and its link with the epistemic virtues. It seems really ripe from empirical research, because you made a comment about the philosophon going better when the students hadn't done philosophy. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem to say very much, be very positive for philosophy, because one might hope that the practice of philosophy at least gives you opportunities to develop the virtues. Your point might have just been that it kind of levels out the field a bit, and as the person organising it, things go a bit better if your students don't come with the propositional knowledge that Descartes said X and Mary Midgley said Y. I was just wondering if what you meant when you made that comment. Just to make a general point that it would be really interesting to know whether doing philosophy in schools did seem to help people develop epistemic virtues.
Thanks, Christina. That's a great question. And I hadn't thought about that empirical question. And I think I'll be really interested to do it. And it would be reasonably straightforward to test. You could just do a quick survey of the people before they did philosophon, find out how much experience they've got of doing philosophy, and then see how well they did in the competition compared with those who didn't. So I think that would be really, really interesting to do. And hopefully as philosophon takes off a little bit in the UK, we'd be able to get a good sample size for such an experiment. I'm not sure I'm the one to do it, but I think that would be really, really interested to hear the results of something like that. If I suggested that philosophy makes people worse at or makes people sort of less epistemically virtuous, then I would want to row back on that. Yeah, that's an awful kind of consequence if that's true. I really hope it isn't. But as you say, maybe we could test it empirically. I think it's the latter of the two options that you presented, that it, factual knowledge of philosophy. That kind of stultified knowledge where people can just name drop and show off, well, that's going to make them quite bad at philosophon, because they're not going to be inquiring into the real deep questions for themselves in that fresh kind of inquiring way that philosophon rewards them for. And so it was really the second of those two options. That's all I meant, that sometimes when you've got an academic background and you're busy showing off your knowledge is not one of the criteria, and it's not something that an epistemically virtuous person necessarily seeks to do. Thanks very much. I'm really interested in that suggestion that maybe there's some empirical work to be done.
Okay, thank you very much, Christina, for that question, and Peter for your response. There's loads of great questions here, and I'm sorry to need to move things on, but it's 10 to 3 now. We're on a tight schedule, so we need to move on to our next speaker. I'm sorry I didn't get around your question, but remember there is the chat box here, and I see quite a few of you are typing into that chat, and you can communicate there with all panelists and attendees. So perhaps you could type your question for Peter in there, and he might be able to respond. And Peter did kindly share his email address on the slide in front of you, so you can get in touch with him about philosophon or perhaps your question otherwise.
Thank you very much again, Peter. Our next speaker is Dr. Laura D'Olimpio, and you can hear that on the next recording on our podcast. Thank you.